like, yeah, bosses at IMP, François Boucher and Ben Wandert. And also there are a lot of Planck results here. So it's done with the Planck collaboration. So since not everybody here is a cosmologist, I have some introductory slides about what we want to measure. Okay, so the object of this talk are the primordial density perturbations and what you can learn about them from the CMB in the broadest sense. And the primordial density perturbations are basically the first classical perturbations that then seed the large scale structure later. So the initial small perturbations, basically. And there are also tensor perturbations, but these we can't measure yet. We are only interested in the scalar perturbations in this talk. And they're given here by phi. And if you want to characterize the physical properties of the primordial density of perturbations, it's a statistical field. So you do that in terms of endpoint functions. And the simplest endpoint function is the power spectrum. And here we go to Fourier space. So here that was in real space, and these endpoint functions are done in Fourier space. So you have the power spectrum, the two-point function. And in principle, there are also higher endpoint functions. For example, the three-point function is called the bispectrum. And that's the quantity we would like to measure. And in the simplest case of a random field would be a Gaussian field. And there, the perturbations would be given alone by the power spectrum. And then all higher endpoint functions are given in terms of the power spectrum. And that we call a Gaussian random field. But what we are interested in is non-Gaussianity. And that means basically that this assumption does not hold, so that also the bispectrum and higher endpoint functions are non-zero. So, and in this talk, we certainly assume that these primordial density fluctuations are created by inflation. So I say it once, since I know that some people are not convinced by the model, by inflation in general. So, and if that is true, then the primordial non-Gaussianities are a measure of interactions during inflation. So non-Gaussianity is equivalent to having connected endpoint function. That's equivalent to having interactions in the primordial field. And in inflation, you must have interaction because you have a potential and you have gravity also. So there are certainly interactions. It's only the question is just, are they large enough that we can actually measure them? So to derive observables from inflation, there are two steps that I will briefly review in each one slide next. Because we need them, or because they appear later in the talk. So the first step is you want to go from your inflation Lagrangian to these primordial density perturbations. And this is a quantum calculation. So so this is quantum mechanics. And then here, the perturbations are classical. And then in the second step, you want to calculate your cosmological observables. And here we would like to care for the CMB. And basically, in this whole field of non-Gaussianity search, we want to use these observations to learn something about the inflaton Lagrangian. Okay, so as I said, these two steps I review them in each one slide. So in the quantum part, we want to calculate the bispectrum in this case, which is the three-point function of the fields at the end of inflation. And how this is done, I'm not going to explain in any detail, but I think it's interesting to know that it's a quantum calculation that goes very similar to quantum field theory, perturbation theory. And the first time it was done by Maldacena, or completely in a complete way, was done by Maldacena in 2002. And the important part is you have a time integral over the interaction Hamiltonian, which of course depends on the model. And then with this calculation here, the formula is a bit of a simplification. But with this calculation, you get then the map from your inflaton Lagrangian to the bispectrum, to what we call the primordial bispectrum. And the cool thing in inflation is that in principle, these correlators, they classicalize after horizon exit. So in some sense, you could measure, if you can measure them, you could measure these quantum field theory amplitudes on the sky, basically. Now, the trouble with this is the second step. So you have to go from the primordial density perturbations, you have to go to the ALM, which are the CMB observables. So this is the CMB sky. And as you probably know, you do a multiple expansion of the CMB sky in terms of these ALM. And so you want to know, what do these ALM look like if I know the primordial density perturbation? And the beautiful thing about the CMB is that it's a linear transformation. So this is a rather simple thing. You need just to know these transfer functions. And so with this calculation, you can go from these primordial correlators to the CMB bispectrum. And that's what we would like to measure in the talk. And these are is the three-part function of these ALM. Okay? Here, the indices are not written exactly right. So all these equations are a bit schematic. So yeah, so as I said, so in principle, there's a map from every inflation Lagrangian to the CMB bispectrum. There's just one problem, which is that for most Lagrangians, this is unobservably small. So often in the CMB, you couldn't, while it is there in principle, a signal, it's so far in the noise that you cannot measure it. But for the models that I'm discussing in this talk, in principle, there is hope to measure them, and that's why we look for them, basically. So, and why is that so interesting? In principle, inflation is simply the highest, or is maybe the highest, well, it's probably the highest, highest energy process we will ever observe. Because it comes from the Big Bang, so these are energies that we will not reach ever with the collider. And here you see LHC energy. And by comparison, these are the energies relevant in inflation. So there's this is the energy scale of inflation, and then a bit below is the mass scale of inflation, and that's lower because you need a very flat potential to drive inflation. So we could just roughly go 10 orders of magnitude higher if we could read off if we could read off the results of inflation on the sky, basically. And in some cases, this could be done with the CMB, but in many cases not, including the simplest ones. And then, of course, we would hope for a future approach for large-scale structure. Okay. So one slide review about the CMB bispectrum estimation. So this is grossly simplified, but what we really want to do is, so for our different inflation models, predict different theoretical CMB bispectra. And what we kind of want to do is to fit the amplitude of these CMB bispectra to what we observe in the data. And the simplest two predictions that come from simple inflation models, and also some more complicated ones, but anyway, the simplest or most common bispectrum shapes are called the local shape and the equilateral shape. And there you see what the constraints are on these quantities. And both of them are in the noise, of course. So there is no detection yet of any primordial bispectrum in the CMB. However, when you do the search, what's important is that there are different shapes. And if you take a shape that is orthogonal to the shape you searched for, then you can completely overlook it in the data, basically. So here, this is an inner product of different shapes. And if this is very small, the inner product, then if you look for the wrong shape, basically, in the data, then you can just overlook it. And that's why in the CMB and bispectrum estimation, what you have to do is to look over all theoretically well-motivated shapes that are orthogonal or near orthogonal to each other. And we have the shapes in this talk, they are orthogonal to the shapes that have been constrained previously. And that's why, in principle, there would be hope to find them. So the subjects in this talk will be three different models of inflation that all of them share the property that they could be observably large, and also that they do induce oscillations in the power spectrum and bispectrum. And that's important because that leads to this property of orthogonality, which means that one could have overlooked them previously. And for each of them, I explain briefly what the motivation was to search for these. So this is often worked by many, many people done over a long time. And then I explain what we did in Planck to constrain these models. And some of them are also, from a data analyzer's point of view, difficult to constrain. Okay, that was the introduction. Now let's go to the first of these models. I will spend most time on the resonance model, since that was sort of the hardest work and also what most people were interested in. So let me first motivate a bit with why we search for these resonance models. And this is motivated by high energy theory. And so I don't have time to explain the details, but what's important is that in inflation, you need a very flat potential to drive inflation. And this flat potential basically is something very unnatural from effective field theory point of view. And you get quantum, for those who know effective field theory, they know that you have get quantum corrections that change your potential by these operators here. And that means that basically quantum corrections, generic quantum corrections, spoil your inflation. They kill the flat potential. And this problem comes in two flavors, actually. For small-scale models, it's called the eta problem and goes only for certain operators. And for large-field models, you are even sensitive to an infinite number of these corrections. And one main solution to this problem that is also, has also been discussed for a long time is that one needs a symmetry that basically kills all these corrections or controls all these corrections. And this symmetry is called the shift symmetry. And this symmetry will motivate these resonance models. So that's why I'm explaining that. And the shift symmetry, basically, the idea is you make the potential exactly flat. As a first step, you make it exactly flat by a shift symmetry. And then you slightly break the symmetry, for example, by a small mass term. And that means that you basically control your UV corrections by the symmetry, by the slightly broken symmetry. And that makes the theory technically natural. And so this is one way that the theorists try to protect the inflaton potential. And for example, for those who know inflation, one well-known model of that is natural inflation, where this is done. Now, the problem is you need a UV-complete model with a shift symmetry because you are close enough to the Planck scale so that Planck operators do correct your slow roll potential. And so you need a UV theory that has shift symmetry. And this was found in string theory, and it's called axion monodromy inflation. Now, I'm not going to explain how this works since I'm not a string theorist, and that's a rather complicated model. But I think what's generically important is that they use the compact dimensions of string theory to basically this circular symmetry or these periodic structures to create this shift symmetry. And and if you do the math, then they found these also periodic corrections to the potential. So you have this, you have the slow roll part of the potential. Here's chaotic inflation, if you know that. And here you have over the slow roll potential, you have overlapping or superimposed little oscillations. And they look like that. And the same sort of potential you get just in general if you assume that this shift symmetry is discretely broken. So if this is not like an infinite parameter or like a constant, if this is a discrete parameter, basically. So you have also periodic symmetry, then you also get something along these lines. So these ideas motivate these models. So to summarize that, so many people probably would say that slow roll works, and as long as this works, we should go with the simplest model. But it is also true that inflation has general problems, and you want to theoretic problems. And it is found that one solution to this problem uses periodic structures in quantum field theory or string theory. And this leads to oscillations in the potential. Therefore, it certainly makes sense to search for these. So the nice part about these is that they could be observably large. And to summarize how that works, basically, so you have these oscillations in the background, in the potential, and that means you get an oscillations in the background equations of your inflaton field. And that leads to oscillations in the couplings because the slow roll parameters basically appear in the interaction vertex. And then you get some, this is also schematic, this equation, but here you get an interaction vertex. So that's what we before saw from this quantum calculation. It looks like something like that. And you have here the oscillating mode equations, basically, the field. And then you have this oscillating coupling. And since these here go with conformal time, basically, you scan with the modes over all frequencies. And at some point, there's a resonance between these two things. And that makes this integral large. So basically, if you don't have this term, they pretty much cancel out these oscillations. But if you have this resonance at some frequency, you get a large contribution to the integral. And that's the mechanism which is called the resonance mechanism. And that was found even before these string theory motivations. So the first idea how this was found was basically, what can we do to get large non-Gaussianities? And so if you do this integral, or the complete version of this integral, you get to first order, you get this sort of primordial bispectrum shape. And that was found by Chen in 2008, Chen and collaborators. And the important part is basically that you have oscillations that go with the sum of the three k's. So your Bell spectrum has three momentum variables, of course, that build a triangle. And the important part, you have this logarithm, and that means that you can get extremely fast oscillations at the largest scale. I will show that in the next slide. Okay, so now we come to some of my own plots, finally. okay, so as I explained before, after you have this primordial bispectrum, the thing you would like to know is what does the CMB bispectrum look like? And you have to project them with these transfer functions. And this is an example where I did this for the equilateral, so which is called the equilateral axis. Here you set, so the CMB bispectrum also has a three indices, and these are the L of the ALM, basically. So these are the angular scales. And if you set them all equal, you get a 1D quantity, and you can plot this. And this is what's plotted here on a logarithmic axis. And what you can get from this plot is two things. First, that the oscillations, so it's logarithmic, the oscillations are faster at low L, and then they get logarithmically stretched to big L. And the other thing you can get from that is that so these have all the same primordial signal, and you see that the faster the oscillation, the more they are damped out by the transfer functions, basically. So the less you see, basically. The faster the oscillation, the more it's damped out. But there's a competing effect with that, which is that the prediction of the primordial signal actually grows with frequency, and it grows faster than the damping goes down, basically. And that means that when you put the two together, the prediction for the primordial signal and the behavior of the projection, then you find that faster frequencies are actually the ones that where there's hope to observe. So you would like to search for large frequencies within the allowed range of frequencies, of course. And we made this, plot. And so this motivates to search at high frequency, and that has not been done previously. So that's something, something new I'm showing you in this talk. So how do you do that? So remember, we want to search basically for this shape now in the CMB data from the Planck satellite.
So you're saying that at a fixed amplitude, the signal always increases with oscillation.
Here. What was the question? So the primordial template, if you want to know how does the signal of the primordial shape go, right, the B of K, then the predictions from theory are that it grows like omega proportional to 5 to the half, if I remember right. And here you lose 1/omega in signal to noise by the projection. So you have two competing effects, right?
But this is somehow assuming that the amplitude of the two-point function is scaling.
Yeah.
Why does that assumption make
sense? So it's a theoretical prediction, but how does the where do you get for fast oscillation a faster signal? A larger signal. Why does it grow like that? I must say I don't know the theory. The theory calculation well enough to know that by heart. But it is true that it goes up to omega 5 to the half. So if you look up in this paper and you see that the primordial shape, this guy here goes up like omega proportional to 5 to the half. Okay, and the projection, yeah, we found with the projection that it goes like 1/omega. So you have to, yeah, these two effects basically. This is of course only true as long as the theory is still under perturbative control. So at some point, this is only valid to some maximum omega for which this calculation is valid. Yeah.
Sorry, can you remind us what epsilon was?
Yeah, sure. So epsilon, so as I said, what's oscillating in this thing is basically the slow roll parameter. So epsilon is the slow roll parameter, and this here is the correction to the slow roll parameter. So of course the correction can't be larger than the bounds on the slow roll parameter, obviously. But this is like a very optimistic thing. And so it depends on how big are these oscillations in the potential, basically. Sorry?
The slow roll parameter oscillates around zero?
Yeah.
But this is the amplitude of oscillations?
It's the amplitude of oscillations, yeah. Ooh. Okay, so now we come to the estimator. so the CMB estimator technology is rather involved thing, I think, and yeah, so I won't review that. I only want to stress one key point, how this is done, and the problem is that the estimator like explodes combinatorically because you have these, you have yeah, it goes like L to the 5, and you have the naive estimator, and you go up to L equals 2000, so you can't do that, and there was a trick to do that, which is very well known, which is called the KSW estimator, and that factorizes this shape into three factors of these momenta, and this leads to the fact that you can do this estimator computationally. So this reduces the complexity so far that you can, yeah, that you can calculate this. So it's important that your shape is of this form, but of course for a generic function you cannot do that. A generic function doesn't have that property, and especially the shape I discussed before does not have this property. So there have been a couple of proposals how to go around this problem for shapes that don't have this property. One is from Kendrick also, for example. And the one was used in Planck mostly is called the modal expansion. And the idea is simply we make a set of separable basis functions, and they look like this. So yeah, basically you expand this in a sum of terms that are of this form here. And with this modal expansion, it was previously possible to search up to omega equals 50. And this was done in the Planck 2013 data already. But as I said, omega equals 50 is about the NF frequency where you would even expect that you could see something. And you can go up to omega order of several hundreds or up to 1,000 maybe. And so we wanted to cover this whole remaining frequency space basically for these models. And so we need a new approach. The problem is with the model, with this trick here, you cannot really well expand this function because you need too many basis functions. And so we found a new basis function that works only for this shape here. And it's a super simple idea. So we use this is a function of the logarithm, and you can basically expand that as a 1D function in terms of linear oscillations. So the difference between this and this is that in this approach, if you expand like that, you can only expand shapes that go like K1 plus K2 plus K3. And this is possible in that shape, basically. And that's a very efficient expansion. And there with these 1,000 modes that you can do computationally, you can cover the whole frequency space. And this one is separable. So this shape here has this property. You can see that if you put in the right instead of the sign, you write a complex exponential, then you see immediately that this is separable.
It's also separable, isn't it?
No, it's not.
But the sign is just exponential of I omega log, so it has complex imaginary powers, but they just k1 to the power of I omega.
Yeah, but you have to, you guess the power.
When is the other, where's the time? When's the time?
Sign
is either the other way, but.
So you have two separate terms, right? They're just two numbers, two. You can speak for both of them independently.
You can think of this as K1 plus K2 plus K3 to a complex exponent, but that's not simple.
It's not separable. Definitely not. We tried actually a couple of other things. So this is a rather obvious thing, but it was not the first thing that came to our mind. We tried some other thing. We tried some integral representation of a to the ix or something. So we tried a couple of more more complicated things. We tried, for example, integral representation of that, and then you could sample the integral of the integral representation. But it turned out that you need hundreds of thousands of terms to do that. At least for the ones that we found, because it's possible you could find a better one. But yeah, so basically in the end we settled for that, which looks super simple, but solved the problem. Yeah.
Something I probably should ask before. So the length of time is not smooth as the sum of the k's goes to zero.
Yeah, that never goes to zero. So the k's have a minimum scale, of course. So there is a minimum for the k. There's a k min, and so this term never goes to zero.
Okay.
There's actually shape which see later where it's k1 minus k2 plus k3, where then this can go to zero, but there's another. Okay, I'll come to that later. Okay, so now come some results, and these results are actually added to the Planck paper this week, so it's a sort of almost a world premiere that you see them, but I'm allowed to show them, which is right because they are not significant. Okay, so let me explain these plots. So here's the frequency on this axis, and here on the x-axis, and on the y-axis here we have the significance of the model, and explain that in a moment. And here you have, this is for temperature, and in the CMB satellite we have temperature and polarization data. So this is for temperature and polarization combined. So, and now what's plotted on here, the significance is what we call the local significance. That means when you fix the frequency and the phase, and then you calculate what is the variance basically you expect in the Gaussian case, and then you use this to calculate the significance. So in this case, that means that here's a phase factor that is maximized over. So we plot here the best fitting phase, basically. And also there's, of course, the scan over many, many frequencies. So it's absolutely intuitively not clear if there's something significant or not. And how you calculate that, I'll come to that in a moment. Let me just make another point. In Planck, we have four different maps. They are made from four different component separations. Okay. So we have, of course, one data, we have the data that comes from the satellite, but you have to foreground clean it, and we do that in four different ways, and these are these ways. And you want to, of course, you want these foreground cleanings to give you compatible results, and they do that to a good extent, especially in temperature, it's where they are rather compatible, while in temperature and polarization, the fluctuation is higher, and it's also a well-known fact that polarization data in Planck is less well under control than the temperature alone. Yeah, so, and as I said, we went to actually omega equals 1,000, so we're here even 1,100. And the point is that, so the largest peaks are about 3.5 sigma in this whole spectrum, and you would like to know if that's what you expect, or if that is something, if that's compatible with Gaussianity. So you have to do the look elsewhere effect. And first let me come to results. So if you search for the highest peak in the spectrum, you find significance of 0.5 sigma after look elsewhere. So it's completely in the noise. So there's definitely no evidence for this model. And you can also do some statistic that counts several of the highest peaks, basically. And if you do that correctly, then you also find that this is also not significant. So no detection. Just quickly, how did we calculate the look elsewhere effect? Actually, normally what one would like to do is just run it on Gaussian maps, but since this estimator is computationally extremely intense, we couldn't do that, so we make an analytic approximation basically to the estimator. It's just a multidimensional Gaussian over, you have a sine term and a cosine term, you can calculate the Fisher matrix between these, and then you can generate mock spectra from this PDF basically that look like that. And then you can compare these spectra to the ones you really found. Okay, so we searched for a couple of other models also, other resonance models. Let me just briefly mention that. These are done with the modal expansion, so with the general approach I said before. So they only go up to omega equals 50. We don't have the high frequency estimate here. And here the raw peak is the highest peak in the whole frequency spectrum. This, the single significance here, this is all in sigmas. So this is the single significance after look elsewhere effect goes up to 2 sigma, which is also not significant. And then for the multi-peak significant, actually there is a peak, which is like 3.5 sigma after look elsewhere correction. So that looks interesting. However, the problem with this multi-peak statistics is if you get a little bit your normalization a little bit wrong, and you push up all these peaks upwards, then for the single peak significance it doesn't change much, but for the multi-peak statistic it does. And that's why we don't really think that these 3.5 sigma are anything to be excited about. So for those people who know these resonance models, there are also people that was predicted that one actually has to take into account the frequency drifting, and that's something we are working on now to take this into account also.
Can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
So what is the multi-peak frequency mean?
but then you're testing a hypothesis that you have multiple frequencies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they say, well, you know, in string theory, you can get everything. But so in this case, the thing is that they use these axions, and they come from integrating the gauge fields around compact dimensions. And the problem is there are, in principle, order of hundreds of axions in string theory, apparently, for standard compactifications. And so if more than one of these would inflate or contribute to inflation, then you could get the same effect on several frequencies. So so that's basically the motivation to search for that. So in my analysis, I went up to 10 to give there some, and then there's a look elsewhere effect over that number also. But yeah, anyway, there's not really a string theory prediction what the maximum number would be for that. Yeah.
But if you're gonna go down that road, I mean, wouldn't you maximize your chi squared if you just had a model where at every one of those peaks that you got in the original plot you showed, you actually had a.
Yeah, that's why you need to calculate and to look elsewhere effect and
okay,
check.
So,
yeah,
so you see, you are sort of marginalizing over all the possible numbers.
Yeah. So yeah, you do. So I do a fragmentist approach. I generate many instances of these spectra from the theoretical distribution of the estimator and compare to these, basically. Yeah. So it's a fragmentist significant look elsewhere correction. Okay, so one more thing we are interested in is actually combining the power spectrum with the bispectrum, and there are not yet official Planck results, so this is more of a teaser which does not have any numbers. But actually, we searched for the same thing in the power spectrum, and from the prediction of the model the power spectrum is often larger, but the signal to noise can be of order one, the relation between power spectrum and bispectrum. So there's still reason to look for the bispectrum. But just in general, the power spectrum is expected to be larger. So we have done this analysis in the power spectrum. Here now, these are a little bit named, a little bit different, but that's basically the amplitude of the oscillation, and that's the logarithm of the frequency. So alpha here is omega here. And these are the peak frequencies in the power spectrum that we found. And they are also not significant by themselves. They're a little bit more excess than the bispectrum, but they're not by themselves significant. And now these models predict that bispectrum and power spectrum have peaks at the same frequency. So that's something one would like to test, not just for this model, but also for some other related models. And that's something in general that we do are working now on in Planck. And here I just plotted for fun, basically, in blue is the true data, and green and red are simulations. And you can try to match the real data with the real data power spectrum analysis. And you see, for example, here at 4 sigma that there is some, some correspondence, which is probably also a fluke, but that's something we are studying right now to combine these two models, basically.
Sorry, I don't understand exactly what you're plotting. So this.
Okay, so this plot or this plot? Which plot do you want me to explain again? The top one?
The bottom one.
Yeah, sorry.
Both of them for feedback.
the bottom one is here again, the frequency on this axis. And here now I plotted a p-value that takes into account this phase look elsewhere effect. So basically, if you had only one frequency that you would look at, then you would get a p-value of 10 to the minus 2 for this peak here. But now, of course, there's a look elsewhere effect over the frequency also. So this is a similar plot to the one I had before, just that I converted sigmas to p-values because I like p-values better in this case.
But the bottom one is that's the bispectrum.
Yeah, this is the bispectrum. Sorry. Yeah, this is the bispectrum. And here I put also two simulations to show that simulations give you similar peak heights, even higher than the data. So this shows also that there is nothing significant here. So, and what we've tried to look at is now is these frequency correlations, if there is something or not. Yeah. For this model and for other models. Okay, so that was the resonance model. So I have two other also oscillating models I'm going to discuss, which will be a little bit shorter than the first one. Okay, so another thing that's a little bit more phenomenologically. So this whole business with the oscillations, And let's say for years in WMAP and so on, one had found in the power spectrum slight hints of oscillations in the power spectrum. They were not significant, but they were at least interesting. And so people were trying to make models where this happens, where you could get these oscillations. And they came up with a generic generic way to generate that is if you have brief violations of slow roll. So in, your inflaton field basically has to, to roll down slowly the potential because that drives inflation. Otherwise, you don't get inflation at all. But if you briefly violate slow roll, then inflation still goes fine, but you have you can generate some effects. For example, this is more of a cartoon picture. But here, for example, imagine you feel your slow roll potential, and your inflaton rolls down, and then you have a step in the potential for some region. Then your inflaton would oscillate back towards the attractor, basically. And this generates you another kind of oscillations. And the same sort of oscillation can be, you can get this from features in the speed of sound, or in multi-field models if you have a sharp turn in field space. So that's only possible if your inflation is made by more than one field, basically. Or if you have some particle physics things, for example, some effect that creates your burst particle production, all these things that drive away the inflaton from slow roll can give you, in general, linear oscillations. So the motivation for these models, to summarize, is as follows. So you can say, yes, most likely the inflaton rolls slowly over the whole time, but it's a generic phenomenological possibility that that's not the case, and so you would like to constrain constrain this sort of models also, and I think in general in cosmology we hope a little bit for a surprise. So it's true that slow roll gives you small non-Gaussianities, but everybody hopes that maybe nature was more favorable with us.
So is there any reason that chemists are big fan of the slow roll?
That chemists?
This guy looks
like a canvas. Oh. No, well, since my own drawing abilities are not enough to make a comic, I just took one from the internet from this guy, and maybe he's a chemist. But, yeah.
Chemists like classifying things. There's so many slow
roll laws. I think chemists about inflation. I totally do.
Yeah, also, I had a professor, actually, at university that looked a bit like that. His coat wasn't white, but beige, and he wore it even in summer, all at any temperature, all the time. So he looks quite similar. He could be a physicist.
And he liked the slow roll.
Sorry?
Did your professor like the slow roll model?
I did never ask him that at the time. That's possible, certainly. So in these things, in general, we call them feature models. And just to give you another cartoon idea why this, what happens here, is you have the same, you have also the sum vertex here, some inflaton vertex, and here you have like three copies of the field, and then you have from your cubic interaction vertex, and you get, here you have slow roll parameters that appear in the S coupling constants, basically. And so if this gets momentarily large, so the derivative of the slow roll parameter gets larger, the slow roll parameter itself for a moment, then you can get a large contribution to this integral. And they lead roughly to shapes of this sort. They look very similar to what we had before, but here there is no logarithm. So you have the linear shape that is directly separable. And we searched for this shape, also in the data, and there we also did something new. We went to higher frequency, factor 10 higher frequencies than before. Now we go up to a periodicity of about delta L equals 10. So the CMB goes from L equals 0 to L equals 2,000, so you have about 200 oscillations in the highest frequencies we look for. There are also, since this is a more general phenomenology, you also have you can have more general models. For example, you can have an envelope here in particular. Okay, so let me show you the plots. They are very similar to the ones we had before, and they are also not significant. Otherwise, you would have heard in the news probably. What's here special is here I plotted you also the modal expansion. So the modal expansion here in this range, we have an overlap between the modal expansion and my high frequency approach, basically. And you see that these agree. And to estimate the look-elsewhere effect. In this case, I actually did map Monte Carlo. Since this estimator is easier than the other one for logarithmic oscillations, I used map Monte Carlo, and here you see that the expected value from for the highest peak for this setup would be 3.1 sigma, and we found 3.2. So there's nothing. However, we also looked at these more general feature models. So these are several different parameterizations that I'm not going to explain in detail. But these are models that appeared in the literature also, which fit in the same class of models, basically, of brief interruptions of slow roll. And you have here the same table in sigmas that I showed you before. And you see, again, the single peak, so for searching for the highest peak, hasn't found anything. But there are some multi-peak excesses, and especially this one is 4.0. I think that's the highest excess you have in the whole Planck non-Gaussianity search. This is after look-elsewhere effect, as I said. However, so first of all, it's not confirmed by polarization. Here you have temperature, and here if you go to temperature and polarization, you go down a lot. So basically, the polarization data is completely against this peak. And the other thing is, as I explained before, that these multi-peak statistics are more sensitive to systematics. So while we investigate this sort of peak, we don't believe that it's something significant or something primordial, basically. And this applies also to the power spectrum, where you can also search for such models, and there was also no detection. So let me come to one last class of models that predicts oscillations, and that's non-bunch Davis vacua. The general idea is, that's also something that people have thought about for a long time, that in the sitter space, the vacuum is not unique, basically. Because it's a curved space-time, so you have no unique vacuum solution. That's a well-known fact from quantum field theory and curved space-time. And the problem is, if you calculate the power spectrum and the inflation, it's basically the square of the solutions of the equations of motions of the inflaton. And anything of that form will do. Everything of that form is a solution to the equations of motion. And one calls this alpha and beta parameters. One calls them the Bogoliubov of parameters. And the problem is, if they are free, if you don't know at all what these are, then you have absolutely no prediction at all for the power spectrum. However, there's a good argument that actually alpha should be 1 and beta should be 0. And that's explained by the chemist again. So the chemist says that if you start the modes of inflation very deep within the horizon, so you, for example, in this three-point integral, you go to minus infinity in the conformal time. So you go you go very deep within the horizon, then there is the inflaton mode is much smaller than the curvature scale at that time. And that means that basically the mode should behave like a Minkowski space. And the Minkowski space has a unique vacuum, and that's the Sponge-Davis vacuum with alpha equals 1 and beta equals 0. So that's the standard solution to the problem. Now, other people, or some people that like to think of more exotic things, have another argument. And their argument goes like this. The modes start very, very early. So inflation is an exponential expansion, of course, and over at least 60 E folds, but could be much more in principle also. And the problem is that these modes are then so small at the early time in inflation that they're actually smaller than the Planck scale. So the argument goes, okay, if these modes are smaller than the Planck scale, then we don't know what vacuum the UV theory would predict at all. So it could be anything. That's the argument of these people. So I would say most people agree with that one. Sorry?
That's a way weaker argument than people could make. Because you could say that your first two examples are examples of this, because that's an argument that says you have to do something funny in arbitrarily large k.
Mm-hmm.
But if you bang the system by having it go around a corner or through a feature, then what will happen is that once you've gone through the feature, the remaining field has to know that it's been through the feature, and so it knows that by not being in the ground state. And so that means that for some range of k's, it will be not the Bunch Davis k. And that's the way that those other examples would be described if you chose to start your description right after the bounds, right after the feature, for example. So the thing is that the right-hand side is as generic as the other two examples you looked at. Only when you push k right up to infinity, or up past the cutoff, that then you start getting this weird transpiling. But you're not going to necessarily...
Yeah, I agree that these two scenarios are related, but I would say that depending on the way how you think about them, other things would appear natural to you then. Let me come to the next slide, and then we discuss it again. But I agree that if you would put your Bogle of parameters to anything, it doesn't really matter at what time you do that. You could do that later by a feature, or you could say we start somewhere at infinity or at some point. So, and these map to each other, of course, in some way. Yeah.
Because all these issues, the right hand side, the argument on the right hand side is always that if you're not exactly adiabatic, which is a function of where you came from, then there's something to look for. And if you are adiabatic, then there's nothing to look for. And so it's not completely crazy that your initial conditions could have been not already.
Okay. So what have people done there? So as I said, the parameter space gets very, very large then if you allow yourself to go away from this from the bunch tables back here. And so people have to try to come up with some generic parameterizations of how one could maybe describe these non-bunch tables models. So one thing that people have considered is, what if we say, well, we put some high energy scale in the theory, and that is higher than the energy scale of inflation, and then we just say, okay, we give this eta parameter, the non-bunch tables, Bogle-Yubov parameter, some small value of order of this ratio, for example. That's one thing one could do. And it turns out, if you do that you just shift the power spectrum, but the bispectrum gets actually oscillations. Oscillations that are not detectively large in the CMB in general, but still. So, another thing people have done is called the NPH scenario, which is a fixed scale vacuum, basically. So, and their idea is, let's say we don't start every mode at the same time or at infinity. We start every mode when it crosses some given scale. So our theory doesn't go higher than some scale, and so let's say. Every time, so the k's, of course, scan over the scale, basically. And as soon as a mode crosses the scale, we set it, we start the mode, basically, and we start them all in one phase. So that's part of the prediction. So we start them all at different times, basically, but at the same scale, in the same phase. And if you do that, you find that you get logarithmic oscillations in the power spectrum. And then there was another idea that people had. So what if we don't go to infinity, but we start the modes at a given initial time, we cut off the integer at some given initial time, and then if you start all modes at the same phase at this initial time tau ini, then you generate linear oscillations in the power spectrum. So to come back what we just said, I think depending on what sort of how you think about modifying your vacuum, basically, you would come to different possible parameterization that you would consider to be a good idea.
But all three of those are pretty crazy parameterizations, right? If you 10 years ago, you did that size where you just take, hyperinflation, instead of starting at the bottom of the trough, you roll down and then you trap yourself at the bottom of the trough. And then non-adiabatic motion before you get trapped in the inflationary thing shows up as you arrive at inflation in a non-bunched state, but it's only true for the small momenta that you're in non-bunched state. It's always true for large momenta, you are a bunched state in those kind of scenarios.
Yeah,
so the whole
that's not the case even these
ways. None of those things are like that, right? Because these are all people that are putting themselves way in the limit there. We're going to go transplanting in and crazy on you.
Yeah, so there are a couple of I agree that there are a couple of problems with these things. For example, how do you cook up UV theory that starts the modes at different times, basically.
Yeah.
I completely agree with that. And so in general, I'm not a huge fan of these sort of things. I think it's relatively simple parameterizations. However, what we did here is basically we do search for these things in the power spectrum. So these are the motivations that are usually put forward to calculate the shapes in the power spectrum that we search for, the linear and logarithmic oscillations. So it's certainly something that has been accepted by the community to be something that's worth searching for. I would say I personally am not such a fan of that.
Maybe a more constructive way to say it is that the random k that's small, mm-hmm. and asking what's, is there a generic signal of that? Because that's a very generic class of things.
Yeah, but of course you must make sure you're not so generic that you can get anything. So.
Well, it's going to be right around, what will happen is, what tends to happen in these things is that it has to happen right around the horizon exit, otherwise it gets washed away.
Yeah.
If it's too early, you don't see it, if it's too late, you don't see it. So,
yeah.
So it's, you've got some sort of a window, and it's not going to be that you can get anything.
Yeah. I agree, but this way of thinking then goes more in the feature, and this, yeah, as you
oh,
said
no,
yourself,
yeah.
is that it's more related to the feature.
Yeah.
To
so,
feature.
So what's wrong with having just a constant beta or unfold beta?
Well, it's the usual thing that the, in all these things, there's nothing in principle wrong with it, but it's the statement that the modes that you understand nothing about
right.
are not adiabatic.
Right.
That's the, that's, that puts them outside the low energy understanding, because you can release a lot of energy from them, and that's exactly the part of physics that we can't. So that means that you've essentially said there's an enormous theoretical error in everything you're doing because you don't understand the physics that you've said is important for what you're trying to see. So it's
but
a class of things
it,
that might
it's
exist.
It's such a simple model, it's just constant. I mean,
but there's no control over the approximation, is the problem.
But it's simple.
Because ultimately,
it's
you
simple.
Can't
so
control.
For saying that the theory is problematic, to say the least.
Yeah, well, maybe it's in the spirit of inflation where also we just ignore the eternal inflation problem, basically, and take our semi-classical calculations and hope it's not spoiled by... But you have the same thing, right? In eternal inflation, if you accept that at some point the quantum fluctuations will like blow up and give you more inflation, it goes forever, then your semi-classical calculation is not completely consistent.
Right, so there's never any general consequences of that you agree with, but the thing is, what you need to know for this
mm.
That's the one advantage inflation has over the alternatives. Mm. So once you leave that, then you're leaving a very special place. And which is fine, I mean, you can do it, but be aware that there's lots
I
of
agree. So yeah, there's, as you just mentioned also, there's the, like a back reaction problem. In principle, you put in energy when you do that. So, and the problem is you must make sure that your energy, this back reaction, does not spoil your inflation, inflation in general. So that's a constraint on these models here, which I have not discussed. But now, if you accept these sort of parametrizations, and you say, okay, let's look for them. The question is, what actually turns out? What do you get in the bispectrum? And and it turns out that so far people had only calculated the bispectrum basically with fixed BK and not with these other two parametrizations, which are usually used for the power spectrum. And if you would like to know something like if you could do a combined search, of course, then at least you have to calculate them consistently, the power spectrum and the bispectrum, with consistent beta parameters. So yeah, we looked a bit, we looked into this calculation. And here's again a schematic calculation only. So this should be a delta B. So the bispectrum is changed to first order basically by, you have two Bunch Davis modes and one non-Bunch Davis mode. And that's why here you get in this K dependence, you get something like K1 plus K2 minus K3. All other permutations of that. So this is basically you have two Bunch Davis lags and one non-Bunch Davis lag, and you get something schematically of this form. And then also, of course, you have this integral. Unlike in the power spectrum, here you must be explicit about your initial time. So if your idea is we start modes all at the same time, then you better start integrating at that time and not at infinity. So this, I would say, this adds more degrees of freedom to the three-point function calculation than you had in the two-point function calculation. But two generic things is that you get, you get this sort of oscillations with this vector, and the other thing is that you get, if you do the integral, the exact integral, you find something, a momentum scaling that goes like 1 over kj. And now, as I said, this is something that actually diverges because this can go to to zero here, this term. However, there is a sine or 1 minus cosine or so on top, so it stays finite. So this is just because I have only written the denominator. Yeah. But still, it peaks at these. It doesn't go to infinity, but still these shapes generically peak for these configurations. Okay, and so just quickly, so when... when you do this integral, and the simplest case is with the Bogoliubov parameter constant that was done previously by Hallmann in 2008, you get something like this, or you get this result here, and so that's another bispectrum shape you are interested in, and this has also the property of having this oscillations, but now in K1 plus K2 minus K3, And so this is another well-motivated shape, yeah, depending on how you see these models, but that we want to look for. And we calculated the overlap of this shape with the template that is often used for this non-bunch Davis search, which is called the N-folded template, which only people that know about the CMB are aware of that, I guess. But if you calculate the inner product of that, you actually find that you can have a rather small inner product, like at up to even 10% level or so. And so that means that you have to search for these shapes, and they are also dependent on the face. For example, that's also something that is, the face is not predicted, but if you look for the wrong face in the power spectrum, then you get in the bispectrum, then you could also get a low overlap. So it's important to look for these. And so, how I came to these models is because our expansion we did before, which exploited this fact that you can write K1 plus K2 plus K3 as a 1D shape, you can actually do the same with this sort of K dependence, with K1 plus K2 minus K3. And this is also separable then, and you can write this sort of basis expansion. And with this primordial expansion, then you can calculate the CMB. And that's an example here of a CMB shape on the equilateral axis for this non-bunch Davis case. And you see that you have these oscillations here overlap. You have some general momentum behavior, and you have some oscillations on top, basically. And so we made some new estimators based on our expansion here. Basically, we wanted to generalize our approach to these models. But these have not yet been applied to the Planck data, so I have no results for these. However, let me mention that other non-bunch Davis shapes have been searched by the Planck data, both in the power spectrum and the bispectrum, and one has not found them. So, but some of them are orthogonal to what we search for, so there's still some hope. So, okay, let me conclude this talk. So, one thing I'm also working on, well, I'm not generally only interested in oscillation, but to keep this talk together, some other things that I'm also working on are these models that also generate oscillations in primordial density perturbations. So one thing was dubbed by Akani Hamid and Maldacena cosmological collider physics. But to be fair to other authors, this is basically a subform of quasi single field inflation, I would say, which was already discussed by Chen and collaborators in 2000. And the idea here is that particles of, so that inflation is sensitive basically to particles of the Hubble, or the Hubble scale. So the inflaton, of course, must be smaller than the Hubble scale, but since the energy scale of inflation is the Hubble scale, you can basically on-shell produce these Hubble scale parameters, particles, if they exist. And then they modify the bispectrum, basically, the bispectrum of curvature perturbations that we looked in the whole talk. Yeah, and they calculated how that looks like. And they find a very interesting behavior, which is that here this mu is a mass parameter, the mass of this particle. So it depends on the mass of this particle. So you get here also logarithmic oscillations, since this is imaginary here, you get logarithmic oscillations also in this quantity. And there's also, in principle, you could measure the mass if you would find that. And there's also a spin term that I did not write here that depends on the spin of the particle. So their idea is basically that if one could measure these things here to exquisite precision, one could, like in a particle accelerator, one could measure the masses and spins of particles up to about the Hubble scale. Much heavier particles are integrated out in the EFT, basically. So much heavier particles you couldn't see, but these ones you could, basically.
Sorry, question.
Yeah.
A constant beta.
A constant beta? No. I don't think so. Yeah, but it's a different effect. So the thing here is basically you have a tree-level diagram here. Let's say two inflaton particles exchange one of these particles.
You
mean the constant beta I had before? Well, the constant beta was this shape here. Okay.
Is that the one?
This is what you get from beta, but with a small amplitude, unfortunately. But this is also valid for all momenta. While the things here that they discussed, this here is for the squeezed limit here. This here is taking, I should have written that. So this is a squeezed limit a squeezed limit approximation. So in the squeezed limit, you get these. Squeezed limit means that one you have you have two large k and one smaller f k. Okay. Yeah, and then you get this sort of shape. No, I would not say that they are related to the non-bunch Davis things. I think this is a relatively solid generic calculation. I also heard, I don't know if that's right, but in the paper they write that, in another paper on quasi-single field inflation, it was written that apparently in supersymmetry, where you use supersymmetry to stabilize your slow roll potential, you would generically expect such particles of these masses, of the mass of the of inflation. In any case, so this calculation is, I think, a solid thing. The only problem is that these are even smaller than normal slow roll. Non-Gaussianities. So what I'm interested here is basically in forecasting what one could do with an optimal experiment that basically gets all modes that the universe has not buried hopelessly in chaos. So then one could say basically what are the highest mass particles one could see with the universe with an optimal experiment. That's basically the idea. There is a way to make these things larger, and that was exploited in quasi-single field inflation, where you have like a classical turn in field space that then couples the two fields with a quadratic mixing term. But that's something more exotic again. But I think this calculation is a generic and nice thing. The only problem is, as I said, it's unobservably small for a very long time to come. And
so this looks to me like this probably looks like the three-point function in quasi-single field inflation, and then mass of the second field is large compared to Hubble. This mu must be like square root of 9.4.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Wouldn't it be more constraining, but that's the case where producing a particle is exponential across the process.
Mm-hmm.
So wouldn't it be more constraining to look at particles, say, below 3.0?
I think this calculation I think is valid, and also you just don't get these oscillations then that you have some power.
In the case where the mass is less than Hubble, or I think 3/2 Hubble, then you change the real part of these exponents rather than
yeah.
So I mean you can boost the Gaussian.
So we agree that this then will be real, right? If you have, so you get an imaginary mu and you're for these lower mass particles, and you get your real exponent to this, right?
I think this formula is specifically the case where the mass is larger.
Okay, so my memory is that they wrote that the formula is valid for all masses, basically. But okay, let's check that again, yeah. But what is, of course, if you go... Yeah, that's true. Yeah. If one has to, of course, it more if you have something. If you go in the direction of multi-field inflation, then you must have the most reproduce these. We have to look in detail. I don't know. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. To finish this now. Let me just briefly mention. There's another mechanism that now the string theorists would like us to look for, which is periodic particle production, which was also. Which is also part of this axion monodromy phenomenology, but I have not yet looked at it. But this also shows another point, a sort of logarithmic oscillation shape. Yeah. So to conclude, there are many. Okay, if you would like, well motivated is your choice. But there are many models of which many papers have been written that have these oscillations and. It's important to look for them because oscillations are easily orthogonal. And that's different from the normal inflation phenomenology, where you have this effective field theory of inflation shapes, and you basically have a couple of shapes, and you look for them, and you basically cover the phenomenology of these. But it's not the case for these oscillations. Yeah. And we did the first high-frequency search for resonance bispectra. We didn't find any, unfortunately. So results are compatible with Gaussianity. It's interesting, I think, in general, that there are string theory models that give you something that you can test in the CMB. I think it's, in general, nice. And I'm sure that people will find more such models and want to be tested in the CMB. Then, we work on a combined analysis with the power spectrum and more shapes. And we will investigate the weakens that have been seen in the data before. So it's true that CMB could still be hiding some signal in these corners, but of course, in the near future, we will have to, retest these models and related ones with more modes that we will then hopefully at some point have sufficiently under control from everything that's large scale structure and related observations. Okay, thank you.
They look like they disagree even on that.
We're a little over time, so maybe we can save us the discussion for lunch. But like one, maybe one question for work.
So on all those ones, you know, the simplest thing that has oscillations is this thing where you have an inflation in a trough, and you just start off where you have a point of, you have a horizon axis, you just haven't quite settled down yet,
mm-hmm.
and the oscillations are coming because you're oscillating around the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So has anyone worked for that template in the
plank data? I think that, well, this is related to the, I would say that's most related to that scenario, right? So because you're basically, these oscillations created by that decay. So, but here, you have your inflaton that this is in 1D, but if you have a multi-field model, you have a similar thing in a multi-field model, you can, let's say, oscillate in the orthogonal direction a little bit and settle towards the valley.
So the difference is that there you're designing a potential. This is just a vanilla potential, so it's just a flat trough. And it's just about initial conditions, so you're just not starting at the bottom of the trough, you're starting on the side of the trough, so then you oscillate down.
So yeah, but you have 2 degrees of freedom, right? You have a multi-field model now. And you just say you start somewhere there.
Right.
I think it is related, and there are people who are working on that. I think that these shapes also have sort of linear oscillations, but the momentum dependence depends, of course, exactly on how your valley looks like and where do you put the field. But yeah, I know also that there, I think the group of Anna Achukaro, I think,
she's
progressed
in turning things and things, but this is much older than that. I mean, people looked in the CMB for what would happen because we did it 10, 15 years ago. But the bispectrum story, I think, at that time wasn't worked out.
Yeah.
So the question would be, since it's such a vanilla thing, the strength theorists are not going to give you something which is going to be magic. They're going to give you some field thing, and it'll be something like that, where it'll be a field rolling around in the
mirror.
Classifying like that, where you're just thinking of how you rolled into the inflationary. What do you?
I think what you do is what you still do is you get oscillating spheroid parameters, right? So
So the question.
It is very similar to that. No. You will have oscillations again.
So are they captured by this? I mean, that's the question to be. That's a very simple physical thing.
It's maybe. I don't know. Okay, so maybe it's something to look up the literature also up there.
I don't know
if that has been studied again.
In that case, are there going to be correlated isocurvature oscillations?
Not necessarily. It depends on what happens, you know. If there were, it doesn't have to be, because it doesn't have to be that you're doing some sort of a... This other field is actually heavy. That's kind of why it's not adiabatic. So it's not like it fluctuates a lot. But even if it did, you can always get rid of that by having some liquid happen later on. So those things you can normally find. But in those cases, the thing that you're worried about would be, would you just see it already? If it's big enough to see in the bispectrum, do you see it in the
you would need a mechanism to,
So
then for all these models, the most general cases have usually the power spectrum larger than the bispectrum.
Yeah.
But the reason to look in the bispectrum is twofold. One thing, it's just something nobody has done yet, so it's important to do that too. But apart from that, there are always some parameter ranges or fine-tuned ways fine-tuned models where you can have the bispectrum bigger. There are some classes of models always where you get the bispectrum bigger. But the generic thing is that you would first see it in the power spectrum, of course. Okay.
Great.